Good to see you.
Yes, good to be back.
Make yourself comfortable here. Oh, Mitch is here. So we're on Daf Kaf Ches Amud Aleph. Yeah. Now what we're going to do here, I'm going to ask for your mechila here. What we're going to do is we're going to learn a little bit on Chaf Ches Amud Aleph, going on to Chaf Ches Amud Beis, and then what we're going to do is we're going to start the mission on Chaf Ches Amud Aleph, and B'li Neder will try to fill in the missing blanks as time goes on. I'm only skipping a few lines in the Gemara, but those lines in the Gemara require a tremendous amount of preparation with maps and so forth and so on. So I don't know if this is the best time, you know, to do that in terms of scheduling and stuff. I have to get this into the fridge. Okay, I'll do that later.
Can I just do it for you real fast?
Yeah, you don't mind. If you don't mind. Just because it'll spoil. It's goat's milk has a limited shelf life, I think. Now, after this year, if anybody's interested, we'll have what I call a weekly Daf Yomi Be'iyun. So we choose a sugya in the Daf Yomi and we go through it more in depth. So that, B'li Neder, bless you, we'll try to do and around, let's say, 9:35 or so, something like that. So now, on Daf Chaf Ches Amud Aleph, we're up to Mai Chasono Diktoni B'masnisen Chasan B'no. So let's see if we can find, is there an easy way of in the, it's about halfway through the Amud. Let's see how we can
Aleph?
Yeah, Chaf Ches Amud Aleph. So did I say Chaf Ches Amud Beis? I may have made a mistake, I apologize. Chaf Ches Amud Aleph is where we got up to. Do you see a Tosus di Ramaskal Rav di Omar Kirabalazar, which is the last Tosus on the Amud? So if you go across, you'll see a little bit above that Omar Rav. You see that Omar Rav? The first word in the line is Mishpat?
Yes.
So we'll backtrack a little bit and go over Omar Rav from yesterday so that we understand what the Gemara is going to say in the sugya that we're up to for today. Achi Abba lo yaidli. Okay, so Rav is saying that my uncle, my father's brother, could not testify on my behalf, either for me or against me. That's called an uncle on a nephew. But not only that, who? Ubno v'chasono. Now the word chasono, which literally means son-in-law, means bito. Now what do I mean by bito? As I've emphasized many times, bito is not ksher liedus. So we can't talk about someone who is a female and is now a relative and is disqualified as a relative. So whenever you see the word chasono, you can really replace it with bito. What do I mean? That as far as kurva is concerned, chasono is bito. Why? Because we have a principle called isho kegufo. Okay, so now let's just think for a second. The uncle has a son and a daughter, and they're both posuliedus, which means that they are first cousins. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, Rav is looking towards his uncle, his father's brother, and he's talking to his uncle, so to speak, about their children. And he's saying that your children, who are the children of Achi Ava, are possible to be made. And so forth. I can't testify to my against my uncle or for my uncle. Ani ubni vechasoni. Not only I can't, but even my son and my daughter. Does everybody understand when I say daughter? It's just, again, I'm just trying to save myself, you know, a little bit of energy here, so to speak.
Yes.
Okay, so let me clarify this, because once we get this, it'll make life easier for ourselves. Chasonu means a son-in-law, because the son-in-law has the same status as the daughter. We're not really talking about the daughter, because the daughter can't convey this in any event, and has nothing to do with being relative. So instead of talking about the daughter, we talk about her husband, because her husband has the same status as she does, and that's called chasano. Okay, so in terms of setting up the generations, you know, if we talk about bino v'chasano, basically that's another way of saying bino bito, but again, bito is not relevant, so we talk about chasano. Now, here's the punchline here in Rav for our purposes. He says, "Ani ubni v'chasoni." In other words, my children, meaning that my children are posuli edus to my uncle. Now, what's the relationship between my children, meaning Rav's children, and his uncle? That's a great uncle. Do you follow what I'm saying? We're talking about a great nephew, great uncle relationship. And in this case, great nephew could be his son-in-law, because that's like a great niece, right? Now, once you add the word great, that's great. But what it really means is that you're talking about shlishi. You're talking about a third generation, meaning Rav's relationship to his uncle or his uncle to him. That's really a Rishon B'Sheni situation, right? Because again, the father and his brothers, that's called Rishon. And when you get down to the children, that's called Sheni. So it's Rishon B'Sheni. Now, once you introduce the children of Rav, the children of the nephew, then you're talking about Rishon B'Shlishi. V'amai. So the Gemara asks, let's analyze Rav. Rav is saying that his children have a psul relative relationship to their to Rav's uncle, which is their great uncle, is Havilei Shlishi Barishon. And the Gemara asks Anan, but when we learn our Mishnah here on Daf Chav Zayin, is that the Mishnah says that Sheni B'Sheni T'nan, which means that in the second generation, so again, as we said before, the uncle is first generation, the children of the two brothers, if you follow me, which we call first cousins, are Sheni B'Sheni. Well, we have Sheni B'Rishon T'nan, which would be the nephew and his uncle. But Shlishi B'Rishon Lo T'nan, the Mishnah doesn't mention anything about going to the third generation. And the implication would be that relationship is so far removed, because it's already introducing a third relationship, that it's not posul yedus. And if that be the case, why did Rav say that his children are posul vis-a-vis his uncle, which means vis-a-vis their great uncle? That's already shlishon barishon. So what the Gemara tries to do is it tries to reinterpret the Mishnah now in such a way that even a Rishon B'Shlishi would be possible, and thus we could support Rav. And therefore, my chasanu dektoni masnisim, chasan bino. In other words, the way that Rav interpreted our Mishnah in terms of the psul krovim, when it says in the Mishnah, achi abba ubino v'chasano, which really meant first cousins, Rav reinterpreted that it wasn't a reference to first cousins, but rather the word chasan, chasano, meant the chasan, the son-in-law, of the ben. So it's ben and his chasan. So it's the ben of the uncle. The ben of the uncle is my first cousin. And his chasan, which is referring to his daughter, that's already mentioned in the Mishnah, and that's Dar Shlishi. That's already the third generation. And in the light of Rav's interpretation of our Mishnah, he came to the conclusion that even Shlishi Barishon is possible Lievis. But the Gemara rejects this. The Gemara says that if indeed the Mishnah, when it says Chasono, it means Chasan Bino, correct? And Bino meaning the son of my uncle, who's my first cousin, his daughter, the next generation, which is Shlishi Barishon, then why does the Tana say Chasan Bino, Lisni Ben Bino? Why doesn't it introduce a grandson and a grandfather? That would be a simple, straightforward case of Dar Shlishi, of Rishon B'Shlishi, correct? So the grandfather is called Rishon, his grandson is called Shlishi. And the Gemara says, Milsa Agav Urche Kamashmal. This is a very common structure in the Gemara, that sometimes the Mishnah will tell you a more complicated case instead of a simple case, in order to teach you, by the by, another Chiddush. And what Chiddush is the Mishnah teaching you is that Baal Ki Ishto, that whatever the status of her is, meaning in terms of relatives, that kurva, that relationship, is equal to her husband, because her husband has the same status as she does. So that's why the Mishnah mentioned Chasan Bino of Achia Aviv, instead of mentioning Ben Bino, which would have been a straightforward way of saying that Dar Shlishi is possible. Instead he wants to tell me a Chiddush, that a son-in-law has the same status as his wife, and therefore the psul of Eidus that would apply to his wife, theoretically, would now apply to him. The Gemara is completely rejects this understanding of Rav in the Mishnah, that chasanu means chasan bino. It means the son-in-law of his son, meaning the son of my uncle. The son of my uncle, again, is my first cousin, and his son would be a Shlishi Barishon. He says the following, Elahad Tani Rabbi Chia, according to Rav, that there's a psul called Shlishi, then we don't understand a brisa of Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia calculates that the total number of psulim in our Mishnah is called Shmona Avos Shehein Esrim V'Arba, that there are basically eight, we call it in Hebrew, Rashei Mishpachot, mean heads of family that cannot testify one on the other, and that will produce 24 specific krovim that are disqualified. So again, at this point, what we'd have to do now is we have to calculate the eight Rashi Mishpacha and then figure out how the eight gives us 24. So in other words, for each one of these Rashi Mishpacha, we're going to get three Krovim. Now those three Krovim are going to multiply the number 8 by 3, hence we'll have 24. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I have a footnote here in which he tells you who these Rashi Mishpacha are, these Avos, which we call them 8 Avos. So I'm going to see if we can go through this list.
Does the 24 include the 8 or in addition to the 8?
Is it, includes the 8.
So that's only 2
for
each one.
2 plus that, right. The Av, right? Okay. So here's what we have. We have Achiv, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Achiv now is going to produce another 2, right, which is going to be 3, because Achiv has also a ben and a bas, and again a basia means a chasan. That's his brother. So 2 brothers are possible, and his brother, again whoever his is irrelevant, his brother is one of the Rashi Mishpacha. Then we have Achi Aviv, we have the brother of his father, that's his uncle, and then we're going to include his children, which we said are first cousins. Now we could say not only his uncle on his father's side, but his uncle on his mother's side, because again we had a whole sugi yesterday that even the maternal relatives are apostles. So my uncle, who's the brother of my mom, right, he's also a Rosh Mishpacha, no less than the brother of my father. And now we have Achoso. Right, because we had Achiv. Again, Achoso is irrelevant, but it means Baal Achoso. So that would be my brother who was married to my sister. Then we have Achos Aviv and Achos Imo, another two. Again, when we say Achos, we always mean Baal. And then we have Baal Imo. Then we have a stepfather, because the stepfather has the same status as my mother. Okay, and finally, we have Chamiv, we have his father-in-law. Okay, so his father-in-law is puzzled to him because of his relationship to his wife. So if you say Balki Ishto, then basically my father-in-law is like my father, if you follow what I mean. I don't know if you want to publicize that, but, right? Okay. Now, in each case, we're going to add a son and a daughter meaning chasono. So, if you have eight Rashi mishpacha and you're going to add beno and chasono, then the total number is going to be 24. That's before Rav. But now that Rav has introduced the children of my uncle, right, the children of my uncle, my father's brother, and not only them, because that's again Rishon B'Sheni, but Rav says even their children. So now you're going to jack it up by another. I worked this out mathematically. I'm just make sure I have this. You're going to have to add another eight psulim. Let's just see how we come up with the number eight, because if you're talking about Rishon B'Shlishi, then what you're going to have is the children of my first cousin, correct? And the children of my first cousin will give me number one, a ben. Number two will give me a bas, which again is chasono, correct? And of course you have to add the ben himself and the bas herself, and the number is 8. Okay, so again, Rabosa, I'll have to get back to you exactly on the number 8. We'll read the footnote. Where am I? I lost my place. Oh, here it is. The Gemara says, if you're introducing, according to Rav, the Dar Shlishi, the third generation, then ha Tolson Vitartin Havi, then the total number is not 24 but rather 32, and we're going to have to add another 8. Why? So I'll read to you the note. He says the following: Mikevan shelchol av mishpacha yesh dar nosaf shenifsal sharegam chasan bino nifsal. So with regard to each mishpacha, which means that we have 8 mishpachos, right? So you have 8 mishpachos. We're going to have to introduce another dar, because from those 8 mishpachos, we're going to also have bino and chasan bino. So why is that only 8? V'hayle Rebbe Chil Amanos Shloshim U'Shtayim Krovim. He says in the footnote the following. Oh, L'chor Yeshnam Arboim Krovim. Right, because if you're adding another 8 avos, is another 24. It's 24 and 24 is 48. Let me see if he says. Ah, no, he says 40. in Shmona Avos Ushmona Banim. If you're adding another eight Avos, then you're adding also their children, which would be another eight, and their chasanim, their male children, which would be another eight, and then the female, right, the chasanim, which is another eight, is another 24. I don't understand, why does he say arboim? It should be 24 and 24 is 48. I'm a little bit confused how he came up with the number 40. Just
24 and 16.
It's, why is it 16?
It's 8 for the male children and 8 for the female.
Female
children.
Is 6. It's 16. Okay. So now the Gemara completely backtracks. In the light of this Braisa, Rabbi Chia, Li Olam says the Gemara, Chasan Umamish. We're going to go back to our original understanding of the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is talking about the children of my uncle, which is my first cousin. Vamai Karile Chasan Bino. So why did Rav, and now we want to reconcile Rav with our Mishnah. So we're going to assume now that Chasano means Chasano Mamish, which means the children of my uncle, which is Dar Sheni. Vamai Karilo Chasan Bino, but Rav called him, when he interpreted our Mishnah, he said it was Chasan Bino. Came into me Alma Kasi Kidar Acher Dami. In other words, he uses the word Chasan as if it was another generation. Why? Because since the Chasan is not part of the biological lineage, so for example, my father's brother, my uncle, married off his daughter to so and so. So he's not part of Zerachi Aviv, right? He has no biological relationship to my uncle. But rather, he comes from a different family. Therefore, Rav calls him a Dar Shlishi. But really, in truth, it's Dar Sheni. Why? Because Baal Ke Ishto. Now, is the Gemara changing its understanding of Rav, or is the Gemara just explaining how to interpret our Mishnah? It sounds like from the next line in the Gemara that the Gemara is still insisting that according to Rav, Shlishi Barishon is possible. Because the Gemara now asks, Ihachi Havile Shlishi B'Sheni. Alright, so at this point, Rabosai, I'm going to take a little break, and I apologize. It's just, I just don't have the amount of time. So let's learn, if you don't mind, the Mishnah on Daf Chavtes. If somebody has a pencil, I would just make a little note as to where we get up to. Okay, thank you.
Ihachi, right?
Yeah, we're up to Ihachi. So, Beli Neder, again, I don't want to promise you because I honestly took on a new enterprise recently. I don't know if you know about this, but I'm trying to learn Daf Yomi. And this sugya that we got to in Sanhedrin is the most complicated sugya that we've had since we started 28 blot ago. It's mamish like learning Yevamos. But let's just take a look at the Mishnah. Again, there are certain parts of the Gemara that we're skipping that are agadita, so that's not a problem. But the real heavy kurva halacha is about Sheni B'Shlishi and Sheni B'Sheni and Shlishi B'Rishon. So we're on the Mishnah on Daf Chavtes Amid Aleph, and the Mishnah wants to know about what's called Bedikas HaEdus, right? Every aid, every witness, and every pair of witnesses that comes to testify has to be interrogated. And the purpose of the interrogation is twofold. First of all, it's to get the facts on the ground. Secondly, it's to make a tremendous effort to establish that the Edom are not perjuring themselves. They are not telling us a fabrication. So this interrogation, especially when we get to Dine Nefashos, when somebody's life is, somebody's being accused of a of a capital crime, his life is on the line. There it's going to even get more harsh, and we're going to be really rough up the Eidim. Now we're talking at least about a lowercase, not so severe. We're talking about Dine Mamonos, but even in Dine Mamonos, we want to make sure that they're not fabricating the truth. So we're going to, it says Ma'aymim Aleihem. Okay, so Ketzad Bodkim is Eidim, when we interrogate the Eidim, Hoyu Machnisin Osom L'Cheder, we take him into a room somewhere in the courthouse. Uma'aymim Aleihem. Now I'm going to read to you the Hebrew translation of Ma'aymim Aleihem, but I think in English we're going to come up with a different translation than the Hebrew translation. Usually the Hebrew and the English are synchronized. Here I think the correct interpretation here is not the literal translation of the Hebrew. Ma'aymim Aleihem means Mafchidim Osam. In other words, we scare them. Now I'm going to offer a different translation. We intimidate them. Now that sounds pretty harsh, right? Why would you intimidate someone? But the answer is that we want to make sure that in case they're not telling the truth, they will break down. So in a certain sense, we're really trying to break them down. They have to really put up a strong force, anti-force against our intimidation in order for them to produce a testimony which we will accept. And honestly, we're hoping, now you might ask me, why are we treating these Eidim as if they're liars? I mean, we don't really know that they're liars. But nevertheless, it's very easy, relatively easy, for two witnesses to corroborate together and just testify and get away with murder. You know, if we want to dramatize it, we could say that even Dini Mominus could be a massive amount of money. And this whole enterprise of intimidating the Eidus is something that we found in the Masechta Sota. The Gemara Sota says that we intimidate the Sota, and the reason for that is we want to get her to confess her crime. Here too, we want to intimidate the Eidim to get them to confess and admit that this whole story was made up. So Ma'aymim Aleihem. The Gemara is going to go into great details to explain how do we intimidate the Eidim. You know, what kind of questions or what kind of statements we make to them in order to intimidate them.
Hey, by the way, it's interesting to note that the witnesses in a capital crime, they have the obligation to intimidate the person about to commit the murder. You have to tell them what your punishment's going to be if you do this, and
right.
So the Eidim have responsibility to intimidate them, and now we are going to intimidate right. The witnesses.
So I use the word intimidate, Gershon, whenever I mean to convey the message that we're trying to get you to back down. You know, you're about to do something which right. We're afraid has very, drastic repercussions, so we want you to back down. That's called Ma'aymim Aleihem. That's my thesis here, that Ma'aymim Aleihem means more than just that we try to scare them. It's there's an agenda here. Yeah. There's a goal. Our goal is to try to get them to stop their testimony. And again, if all this is on the base of the assumption that they may be lying.
How do we balance the cheskas kashrus that a person is supposed to have and this, which is almost the exact opposite? When do you apply one?
Since there's a nidon involved, somebody's being put on trial, that nidon also has a cheskas kashrus. So we're trying to balance between the cheskas kashrus of the nidon and the cheskas kashrus of the eidim.
You have a possible innocent victim.
Correct. Even though it's Dine Mamonos, again, we're not going to jack it up to the highest level of Iyum. But nevertheless, even in Dine Mamonos, everyone is considered guiltless until proven guilty. But I think, Mitch, your question will become clearer as we go through the Gemara. Okay. Motziyim eskol adam lechutz. In other words, after the Iyum is over, then when we begin to get down to the nitty gritties and ask the questions and fire them at questions, it becomes private. So the implication is that the Iyum itself could be public in nature. And once the Iyum is finished, and again the Gemara is going to go through the details about what this Iyum is, what it consists of, then at that point we go into a private mode. And Motziyin Eskola Adam Lachutz. Who's left? Who's left in the room with the judges? Mishairina, we leave Es HaGadol Shebahem, which could either mean the oldest of the Edim, or perhaps it means the more honorable of the Edim. But anyway, there's somebody called the Gadol Sheba Edim. And again, we have to ask why we got rid of everybody. Why are we doing this in private? We'll get to that in just a second. Vi Omrim Lo, and the judges say to him, and Mar, tell us, Hechata Yodea Shezeh Chayev Lezeh. So, it's interesting. Before we interrogate the Edim, we ask the Edim, what are you here for? What is the thrust or the impact of your testimony? And they say, so-and-so is Chayev. He has to pay a sum of money. So now when we get to the questions and the specifics, the first question we want to ask is, how do you know that so-and-so has to pay the money? Im Omar, if the witness responds and he says, Hu Omar Lishani Chayev Lo, which is called Hodas Bal Dinim, and it's I heard from this person that he owes money, meaning that the defendant himself confessed that he owes this money. Where was the plaintiff? Meaning the following. Let me see if I can explain this in a logical way. In Dine Momenos, in monetary law, confession is very iffy. A person could say all sorts of things. You know, I could joke around with you, say I owe you $1 million, you know, in conversation or whatever it is. The first condition that has to be met in order for Hodas Bal Din to operate and to be effective is that it has to be befunov. Befunov means it's got to be in the presence of the mischayev, okay, that's not a good word, of the person to whom, let's say I'll talk in first person, right? Let's say I'm confessing that I owe you money. You have to be there at the time that I make the confession, because that gives my confession a certain serious nature to it. Otherwise, I can say what's called Meshata Nibach. Again, I don't want to confuse it with different words. We're going to get to these words as we go along. But I can say that I wasn't serious about it. So the first question that we ask, if the aide says, how do I know that he's chayav? Because I heard his hodah, I heard his confession. Then we're going to have to ask him the following question. Where was the tovea? The tovea is the plaintiff. Was he there at the moment that you heard the confession? If he wasn't there and you just heard a confession from the defendant, that confession is not valid. You can't testify in that. So even if a person made the statement in front of witnesses, I owe such and such a sum of money to so and so, then he may have said it for various reasons and it wasn't serious. So let me just read to you this important note. He says, one second, I lost it. Oh. If the aide says, and again, right now there's only one witness who's being interrogated, he says, Hanitba Atzmo, the defendant himself, Omar Lishu Chayav La Tovea. So you have a plaintiff who's suing, Reuven is suing Shimon, and the aide is saying, well, Shimon told me that he owes this money to Reuven. Is Harei Zeh Shelo Bifnei HaTovea. V'haya Zeh Shelo Bifnei HaTovea. And this took place when the plaintiff was not there. Ein zu edus. That's not considered testimony. That's not valid. And that's not hodas bal din. Why not? Shekein adam asui lomar, a person very often says, ani chayav kesef leploni, afal pishein zu emes. For example, one reason he might say this is kidei shelo yachshavu li ashir. I'll give you an example. When somebody buys an apartment in an expensive neighborhood and they don't want to look like they're rich guys, so they'll tell you the bank owns the apartment. Now, 99 out of 100 cases, that's truth. Because, you know, when you take a mortgage, especially in this country, the bank really owns the house. You'll be paying for the next 25 years, you know, until you own the house. But, I mean, I guess that's true in any country, but... So that means he might have been embarrassed to admit that he bought an apartment, you know, and spent, you know, $1 million on an apartment. So instead he says, oh, the bank owes the apartment. I owe this money to someone else. That's the way that a person tries to conceal his wealth. And nobody wants others to think that they're wealthy. Okay. Now, let's say the witness responds in a different way. Instead of saying that the defendant in front of me confessed that he owes money to the plaintiff, the aide says, "Ish ploni amar li shu chayev lo." I heard from somebody else that saw the defendant. We'll call him. What do we call him? Shimon, I remember what we called him, right? That Shimon borrowed money from Reuven. Is lo amar klum. In both of these cases, number one, who amar li shani chayev lo, that the defendant confessed in front of me that he owes this money, or if somebody else told me that he was there and he saw Reuven borrow the money from Shimon, or Shimon from Reuven, I'm sorry, I keep getting that mixed up. Is lo amar klum. That's not considered eidus. Why? Because we have a concept called eid mi pi eid, which is pasul. We don't accept a testimony that's based on someone else's testimony. You have to know it yourself in order to testimony. Ad shi yomar, until the witness says bifanenu hodolo shu chayev lo masayim zuz. Now, bifanenu means that the nitba was moded to the tovea. Do you hear that, Rabbo? Say to the tovea that he owes him 200 zuz. So that the nitba now understood that his confession took place in front of two witnesses and in front of the tovea. And since the witnesses were there and present at the time of his confession, he, the confessor, the defendant, understood very well that this was a very serious confession, and that he basically understood that these two witnesses would testify on his confession, on his hodah, his admission that he owes the money. In that case, the hodah is binding. We assume that it's absolute truth, and hodas bal din kemei edim dami. So we finally got to the point in which this first witness has calmed us down, so to speak, has convinced us that he has a valid testimony. The acher kach machnisin es hasheni. Now we're going to go through the same bedika in a private room with the second witness. Both can also. We're going to repeat all the questions that we had. And hopefully, at the end of the day, if we want to be optimistic that this testimony is valid, the second testimony will coincide with the first testimony of the first witness, and he will say, "Bifanenu, in our presence, he was modet to the tovea that he owes him 200 zuz." Nimtzu divrehem michuvanim. If there's no discrepancy whatsoever between the two witnesses, but rather their testimony is mechuvanim. Mechuvanim means it's fit one for the other. Do you have a translation into English of the word mechuvanim? I need an English word. The opposite of discrepancy.
correspond.
Correspond. Oh, if the two testimonies correspond, then nosim v'nosim v'dovar. In other words, now we're going to enter into stage two, and we're going to deliberate as to whether or not this testimony is enough evidence to draw a final verdict that Reuven has to pay Shimon, or Shimon has to pay Reuven, whatever the case may be. Okay. Now, I think I once mentioned to you in the past, I don't want to go over it again, a story about the Vilna Gaon, and basically what happened was that the two witnesses, each separately in a private room with the Dayanim, said exactly the same thing, like word for word. And in such a case, the Yerushalmi says that Rav Huna, if he saw that the witnesses were saying exactly the same thing with the same expression, he was very, very wary of such testimony. He was afraid, he was choshish l'ramos, that they were fooling them, because it's impossible for two people who saw something that they would use the same exact words to express their testimony. And in such a case, again, I don't know how far you're going to go with this, but the Gaon went very far, and he thought that we have to throw out the Edom in such a case. We really know that they're falsifying and they're doing this in collusion. Okay. Now, Shnayim Omrim Zakai, now we're up to the decision of the Beis Din. Two out of the three judges say Zakai, he's off the hook. Shimon doesn't have to pay Reuven. V'yechad Omer Chayov, since there's only one dissenting view that says that Shimon has to pay and there's enough evidence to force him to pay, is Zakai. Then the Torah says we rely on Rov, Achrei Rabim Lahatos, and we have two out of three judges that say he's Zakai. Shnayim Omrim Chayov, V'yechad Omer Zakai. Again, the other, the flip side, if two out of three say that Shimon is obligated to pay this money, Chayov, he has to pay the money. Now, what happens if Echad Omer Chayov, Echad Omer Zakai? If we only have two judges out of the three who are willing to take a stand, and the third judge says, any day, I don't know, is then we cannot issue a verdict, even afilu im shnayim ezakim or shnayim echayim, even though we have an absolute guarantee that we'll have a rov here, the echad omer eini yodea, because we have two against zero, if you will. So that certainly is a rov, but nevertheless, you'll see for adayon, we're going to have to add two judges. And again, the number two is indicative of maintaining the odd number of judges. It always has to be an odd number. It can't be a Beis Din Shakul.
Sure.
And therefore, if we add two judges, we're going to have now a court that's comprised of five judges. Is that correct? We had three. We're adding two. We now jacked it up from three to five. So we still have an odd number of judges on the bench. And the what has to be understood here is that since one of those judges said eni odea, so what we're not gonna have a final psak from him, right? So if you add two judges, then lechori you still have an even number of judges, because the verdict might be two against two, because one of them is saying eni odea. So he quotes here in the footnote to Lavush, he lived five centuries ago, and he says the reason why we add two judges is because Chayshinon Shemayachzer Bozeh Shomerni Yodeh V'yaskim L'das Hadayin Shosifu V'yukan Shnayim Mechayvim U'Shnayim Mezakim. So the Lavush basically says that although one of the three judges in round one said Eni Yodeh, it could be that after we add new blood, new opinions, so to speak, onto the court, then the one who said any yodea is going to say, wow, I saw the light and now I have a decision, and he's going to take a stand on it. Now if he takes a stand on it and we only added one judge, then we're left with an even number of two against two. So therefore, in order to avoid a Beis Din Shakal of an even number, we have to add two judges, so that in any event we'll be able to get a rov, we'll be able to get a majority. Now the Mishnah says, Gamru es hadavar. Finally, the judges came to a common position, a common decision of either all of them unanimously or most of them. Then hayu machnisin osan. Now we're talking not about the Eidim already finished, but we're talking about the Bali Dinim, that's the litigants of Reuven and Shimon. Is machnisin osam hagadol shebadeirim omer, and the oldest or the most important or honorable scholar of the judges, he'll declare ish ploni ato zakai or ish ploni ato chayev. Now, by guaranteeing that a specific judge on the court will pronounce the decision, and this is the gadol shebedayonim. So, first of all, that's called kavod, kavod for the gadol shebedayonim. But moreover, what that means is that we'll never really know which of the dayonim, decided and handed down whichever verdict. We don't want the litigants to know which of the judges specifically were on this side or on that side. So if you have a standard formula that it's always going to be the, by definition, according to protocol, the gadol shebedayonim who's going to make the declaration, then you'll really never know exactly which dayon held which position. And finally, uminayin, how do we know that the din is lichsheyetze, that when one of the dayonim leaves the bezdin, lo yomar ani mezaka v'chaver mechayvim, the dayan should not reveal his opinion? You see, there's a very strong temptation and desire for the dayan to come over to the litigant who was found chayev, right, and tell him, you should know, I was on your side, right? I really wanted to. It's like when I met Eli Yishai in shul, he davens in the same shul as I did. I don't know if you remember Eli Yishai, so I told him, I voted for you. I was one of the many people who wasted their vote, I was in favor, So he wants to come over to the litigant and says, you should know, I was on your side, I was mezaka. So he's not supposed to say this. He says, "Chaveri mechayvim." It was my other colleagues who said that you have to pay. But my answer is, "Chaveri rubble." I can't do anything because the rov was with them, and therefore my das is batel. Al zeh nemar lo selech rochel v'amecha, which is the source for rechilus. Rechilus means that you don't reveal secrets in order to get benefits when people, might serve to lose as a result of your revealing their secrets. Holech Rachel Megalas So, this is a pasuk in Mishle, that by revealing this secret as to which Dayanim held which position, he's going to create a certain hatred and animosity in the heart of the Baldin, the Baldin that was found Chayov, against, he'll hold a grudge against the other Dayanim. And that's called rechilus. In other words, let him be in doubt as to which dayan was the one who messed him up, so to speak, messed him over by saying that he's chayav. Now, I have here an important note about rechilus in this context, which I want to share with you. He says the following. The Gemara quotes, the Mishnah quotes two psukim. The first pasuk is in Parshas Kedoshim in Torah Shvechsav, Whereas the second pasuk is in Ksuvim, that's in Mishlei. He says that Afal Gav Sha Pasuk Rishon Min HaTorah. So why did the Mishnah have to add a pasuk in Mishlei? He says the pasuk of Lo Selech Rachel in the Torah could have been understood as a prohibition when a person wants to create or generate animosity. But if he's just trying to save himself, if he's motivated so that so and so won't have animosity to him, then maybe that's not called a violation of Lo Selech Rachel. So the Dayan doesn't want the Baal Din to hold a grudge against him, so he tells him, you should know, I voted in favor of alleviating you from any obligation. I said you were Zakai. Therefore, we need the Pasuk in Mishlei. The Pasuk in Mishlei changes our understanding of the Issur Achilus in such a way that it would encompass this case where the Dayan wants to tell the litigant that was found chayev that he was in favor of being mezakeh him, because the pasuk in Mishlei says megalas sod. Now, in the case of megalas sod, we don't know for sure that if somebody, you know, he reveals secrets, that his kavana is to try to cause animosity. But rather, the pasuk tells us that when the Torah says Lo Selech Rachel, it means don't be megalas sod. That which is secret, and there's a reason why it's kept secret, don't go ahead and reveal it. Even if your intention is to save your own skin, you know, it's to maintain a good future relationship with this litigant, nevertheless, don't be a megalas sod. So that's the addition of this pasuk in Mishlei that the Mishnah adds. Now the Gemara wants to know the following: Hechi Amrina Le. How do we implement this abstract concept called Ma'aimim Ala Eidim? What kind of scare tactics can we use? Amar Rav Yehuda Hachi Amrina. This is what we say to them based on another pasuk in Mishlei. It says Nesiim V'ruach V'geshem Oyin. And then it says, Ish mishalel b'matas sheker. Which means that as a result of false testimony, which is called mishalel b'matas sheker, nisim v'ruach geshem ayin, the clouds that carry the rain, ayin are nowhere to be found. Basically what we're saying is that there'll be drought, there'll be famine in the land, and that's a punishment for false testimony. Now it's interesting because everyone's going to suffer as a result of this drought. So why should we all suffer on the planet Earth, or at least in a certain area, because of the iniquity, because of the sin of these Eilei Sheker? Amar Rava, Rava says, Yachli Lememar, the Edom could say in their hearts, Shav Shani Havi Kanfa, V'abava Umana Lo Chalif. Shav is an Aramaic shortening of the word Sheva. Shani means years. So for 7 years there was famine. And now, havakanfa. So let's leave out the words havakanfa for just a moment. The above means at the threshold, the opening, the gate of umna. Umna means a professional, some sort of baal malacha. Lo chalif. There was no famine. Why? Because he had a trade, and he could always support himself with this trade. So even when the financial situation is very dire, but he could still keep his head above the water. So Shav Shani Havi Kanfa. Kanfa means a famine. But above Umna Lo Chalif. But the famine did not affect this Umna, this professional. He has a guaranteed income. What do you say, Gershon? Kafna, I'm sorry, kafna. Kafna is an Aramaic word for what we call in Hebrew ra'av, a famine. So basically, the Edom are not impressed by this ium, by this threat, that if they testify falsely, then they will bring famine into the land, because they feel they won't suffer from the famine. They're not impressed because they have an umnus. They have a certain guaranteed income. So that's not going to be a good idea for an ium. Therefore, Rava is going to have to substitute a different ium than the one that we had from Rabbi Yehuda. Okay. Omar Ella, Omar Rava, Amrina Le, this is what we're going to tell the Eidim, based on again a Pasuk in Mishlei. Mefitz v'chere v'chetz shanun, ish ona b're'eu eid shaker. So the last part of the Pasuk is addressing the case of the sin of eid sheker, and what's going to result, what's going to happen as a result of the sin. It's going to be mefitz v'cherev v'chetz shanun, and this is a reference to a magefa, some sort of a plague that's going to come into the world, and as a result these Edom themselves might die. Now what does chetz shanun mean here? So Rashi tells us that these are names of weapons. For example, cherev is a sword, and it seems that mefitz v'cherev are different weapons that are used by the Malach HaMavis. And the Gemara understood, Rabbah understood, that the Malach HaMavis is equipped with these dangerous weapons at a time of Magefa, at a time when there is a plague in the land. Now once again, just like we saw Rabbah when he argued against Rabbi Yehuda, we can again, Lechora, present the same argument against Rabbah. Amar Rav Ashi, or Amar Le Rav Ashi, Yochle Lememar, the Edom could say to themselves, in their hearts, in their minds, that Shev Shani Havi Musna, for 7 years there was a Magefa. Magefa is called a Musna. Musna means Miloshan Misa. But for Inish Belo Shane Lo Shachiv. And yet nobody died before that time. So even when there's a Magefa, yeah, I'm thinking out of China, right? Even when there's a Magefa, it's possible that the Edom are not afraid, they're not full of fear by the impact of the Magefa. So that's not a good Iyum. And the question now is, what would Rava counter against Rav Ashi? Because, in effect, Rava himself put that same argument against Rabbi Yehuda. And so what did Rava gain by saying that we put the fear in their hearts because of an impending Magefa, which is going to be brought against the people who testify falsely? In any event, Ella Omar Rav Ashi comes to offer a third possibility as to what the Iyum is. Omar Li Nosen Bar Marzucha Amrina Le, we say to them, Sadi Shakri Aograihu Zile, that these Edim are lowering themselves by testifying falsely. They're actually humiliating themselves in the eyes of those who paid them off. You know, the assumption is that the reason why they might be tempted to come up with this whole false story is because somebody's paying them. Let's say Reuven is paying them to testify against Shimon. And that is so humiliating. You know, the guys who paid off the Edom, in a sense, are boasting. Look at these Edom, they're so low, we just bought them off. Again, this has to do with Achav, who's the king of Israel. And if you may recall, we mentioned earlier in this Masechta that he purchased a vineyard from Navos HaYisraeli. Navos himself did not want to part with the vineyard. He didn't want to agree to sell it. So Izebel, that wicked queen, the wife of Achav, says that, you know what? You don't have to get worried. She's going to make sure that this vineyard will pass into your, meaning into Achav's possession. Shekerem Novos Yavro L'Rashuso. The Kerem of Novos would ultimately come into the possession of Achav. So what did she do to guarantee that? She wrote to the city, the elders of the city of Novos, which is where this you know, where the Kerem of this Israeli was. It was Novos in Novos. And she writes to them, Hoshivu Shnaim Anoshim B'nei Belial Negdo, meaning set up two witnesses, B'nei Belial, evil people, and they will testify against Novos Yisrael, Yiduhu Lamar, and they will testify against him, and as a result, Beirachta Elokim V'melech, which means that there will be a Gmar Din L'Misa, and Novos will be put to death, and then Achav will inherit the Kerem, the vineyard of Novos. In other words, what the Gemara wants to prove from these psukim in Sefer Melachim is that those who hire false edim, they pay the bribes, like Izebel, is mevazin osam, because they're called b'nei Belial, which is a negative pejorative term. Okay, this is where we're going to stop for today. So I wish everyone a good day. And do we